the string wizard himself, John McEwen. You may recognize more immediately from the all the great work with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and John will revisit with us and just catch up on some things since his last visit.
Hi, this is John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and you're listening to the other Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. Now, the other Steve Martin, one plays the banjo and makes albums, and one plays music. This is the other one that plays music on his show. But I'm the only John McEwen in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, that is. Check it out, johnmcewen.com.
I'm very happy to have on Unreal Bluegrass today John McEwen, the original, the string wizard, one of the original founders of Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And I'm just always happy to have a chance to chat with John about whatever's on his mind.
Oh, it's been a long, hard road, Steve.
Hey, there's a song title right there. There's a couple song titles right there. You, John, this is interesting to me, and I still went about a week ago. I'm getting texts. I want people to understand how, to me, this is still an unusual event. Maybe not so much in your life, but I'm getting texts from John, and John is on an airplane and flying back from, I guess, was that the museum, the Colorado Hall of Fame Music Museum?
I just texted you from the plane coming back from the Colorado Music Hall of Fame.
Yeah, yeah.
So I could say that on your show. Yeah. Yes, we were inducted.
so congratulations. So I'm getting texted, and I'm thinking, here's John going away from me from in a westbound plane, leaving Denver. I'm in Kentucky, and I'm getting messages from someone who's heading away from me. I just for that moment, I had one of those Zen moments about this still doesn't make sense to me. How is this possible?
It is a weird world we're in, and it's wonderful to be able to email and stuff from 35,000 feet.
Isn't that so bizarre? I mean, I know we do it, and I've done it, but there's something about getting a message from you, you know, a week or so ago, and when I visualized what was happening, I thought, well, I don't know. So anyway, good. I'm glad you did, so I'm happy to talk to you.
Well, we've been trying to get together for about a year.
Well, yeah, so I think we did initially right around the big anniversary event of Will the Circle Be Unbroken, and you were doing a bunch of things, and I just thought it'd be nice to catch up, see what you've been up to. I know you're you're all over the place traveling and playing everywhere. I know you got some issues, some dates coming up on the West Coast, but I just thought I would say, what's been going on lately. I know, well, we were talking about the possibility of you maybe possibly writing a book. I don't remember if that was a real thing or not. Or are you still? Is that
possibility
still
of which? I'm sorry.
Writing a book.
Oh, I've been working on that for years.
Oh, okay. All right. That's still
in the process. It's coming along.
Okay. Well, there's no sense to rush it.
Trying to find the storyline that weaves through it, rather than just as a count of a bunch of different things.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting process. I'm a very fortunate guy, Steve. I was a teenager in L.A. in the 60s with no direction, and then I saw the Dillards, and I went, I want to play the banjo and be in a group. And then when I was driving to college one day, I spent more time in the music room practicing the banjo all day than I did studying, but that got me my first D. Which was in calculus, which let me know my math career was over. And but on the way to school one day, I heard a song on the radio that was by the Byrds, and I went, wait a minute, the bass player in that group is a mandolin player from San Diego in a group called the Scottsville Squirrel Barkers. It was Chris Hillman.
Oh, God.
And I knew that, I figured if a guy from San Diego could get on the radio, maybe a guy from Orange County can. And it was where I really kind of started working at. And then a year later, the Dirt Band came along. And that was like the dream. I just want to get
the
on the
dream.
Radio. I don't even know why, but who knows why.
Well, it used to be a really good way to pick up. I don't know. I sometimes, maybe I'm thinking back to the old rock and roll days, which is when Nitty Gritty and NGD came around, but it used to be a real handy thing to be able to, in conversation to say, have you heard my band on the radio? Maybe it was that simple when you were that young, John. I don't know.
It's just the desire to reach people with something.
Oh, sure. I'm just kidding.
Years went by. We've been very fortunate, and that's happened both for the band and my solo work. Because I was a solo player before the dirt band, and then...
And you still are.
I started doing that when we came back from Russia in 1977. I started playing solo again.
Isn't it funny, and you mentioned the Dillards, isn't it funny how they because of their, you know, you talk about a journey for them, but they're a band, all of a sudden they go to California, they're on TV, they're traveling all the college circuits, and so many people that you talk to, their first exposure was with the Dillards. I remember I was interviewing Byron Berline about a month or so ago, and, you know, he knew he wanted to play music and do stuff, and he saw the Dillards, and that was the whole thing changed for him at that point.
Yeah, they met him on the way to California. They went to California, had no money, and had to stop in Oklahoma City and get jobs to buy gas.
he didn't tell me that.
Yeah, and then they got to L.A., and Rodney's one of my best friends, and it became over the years. Rodney has told me before about how they got to L.A. and they played a club, and somebody heard them and said, "You want to make an album?" They made the Back Porch Bluegrass album.
Yep.
And somebody came to see them and said, "You want to be on the Andy Griffith Show?" And within 6 months, they had made the beginning of their career happen.
It is phenomenal. I mean, I knew a little bit about Byron being in the middle of the country, and I wasn't quite sure how he connected up, but yeah, that's what it was. He takes his fiddle and he plays backstage with him, and then not too much longer, he's heading out to California.
They flew him out to California to play with him one period, and did that album that featured the fiddle with them back in the Dillards with Byron Berline.
Yeah, isn't that weird? Rodney, by the way, I'm trading email with his people to get. I would love so much to talk to Rodney on this show.
Oh, that'd be fun.
I'm trying. So yeah, so we that was interesting. That's what I wanted to mention to you is that, you know, the Dillards. I don't know. You know, everybody, the bluegrass community as a whole. Of course, you got Flat and Scruggs and all, but they don't realize how sometimes important the Dillards were in the path that they took with the college, with the folk scene, and what they did, and how they that lurch out to California. All of a sudden, you got real bluegrass music being played on both coasts. And I think the Dillards were just such pioneers; people didn't recognize it at the time.
They inspired many.
And then guys like you came along, and there's John McEwen and playing solo, and then the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, which are just legendary, all the great stuff you've done.
I don't think there wouldn't have been a Will the Circle Be Unbroken album if the Dillards had come to California.
Oh, I know. Okay. You mean
because
Go ahead.
Well, they came to California. I got excited about playing the banjo, and I started doing that and working at it and different things, and I got in the Dirt Band, and we were doing a wide variety of music that sometimes was bluegrass and banjo features, and Earl Scruggs came to see us because of that. He told me once something I'll never forget when I said, "Why did you come see the Dirt Band in 1970? And he said, "I wanted to meet the boy that played Randy and Rag the way I intended to."
said, "Is he here?"
Yeah, I looked around the room and said, "You must be, you mean me?" So, 6 months after that, I asked Earl if he recorded the Dirt Band. He said, "I'd be proud to." And that was the beginning of an album that wasn't named yet. The next week, I asked Doc Watson I said, "I'm with Nitty Gritty Dirt Band." And his son, Merle, had told Doc about us and played our music, and he liked the way the band sounded. And said, "If Earl's going to be there, I want to be there to pick." And that's how that started. And if we hadn't had Earl Scruggs, we wouldn't have had a Circle up.
And if the Dillards hadn't come out, you wouldn't be playing banjo, and that's almost like for one of a shoe and for one of a nail. That story about, you know, losing the war.
The horse was lost. The cow was lost. Yeah.
That's amazing. And, you know, and we've talked a little bit about that that Nitty Gritty, that Will the Circle Be Unbroken album, which, uh-huh. Was it the 40th anniversary when we were talking last, or the...
Yes, I think so.
Which is still...
If it hadn't been for Jeff Hanna picking the right songs to sing, we wouldn't have gotten on the radio for them to have heard it, you know? If the other guys in the band hadn't been able to play the different music we did and have the success of the Uncle Charlie album, I would have just been a kid from Orange County without a group saying, hey, would you record with me, you know?
Think about the odds.
Yeah, I can say, I got this band, and we would like to have you record with, you know? So it was a team effort.
Think of the odds, John, of all those things coming together, not just the coincidence that led to that album, but doing that album today and putting the finished product out and having it be as successful as it was in today's world.
There's many things that happened to make it work. One thing that made it work is my brother's concept of the artwork and editing. He sequenced the album and put it together, and so visually and audio-wise, it was a pristine package. And it put all those people in a light that they hadn't been in before.
You, John, last time we talked about this album, and by the way, I steal bits from it all the time because of all the nice background discussions leading up to the tunes, and we talked a little bit about the recording process where you just kind of put the tape in and let it roll until you got all that nice ambient discussion in between takes and whatnot. And was that a planned thing, or was it just easier to let the tape roll and figure it out later?
I'm sorry, was there what?
Was it a plan to record all of the conversation, or was it just that you let the tape roll? And
that was my brother's plan. He had his tape recorder set up, running at 3 3/4. That would, the reels were changed when the reel would run out, but it was to catch all the mics open all the time.
Wow.
For the whole, whenever somebody was in the studio for use later, which was use, and to capture the essence, because it's not just about the music, it's about the people that make it and about them. And you can get windows into that by listening to them talk to each other. And or just hearing their voices was exciting to me. To hear Maybelle talking instead of just singing was a wonderful thing, because you felt the connection. It kind of put her across the table instead of on a stage. You know, it's just, it's like having her in your kitchen.
It is.
And...
You know, one of my favorites.
I remember playing the Flatten Scruggs live at Carnegie Hall album. I'd play Mama Blues over and over just to hear Earl Scruggs say, "What is it you want, son?"
Talking on
you. You want a drink of water?
Talking on your banjo. Yeah. I know what
just
you mean.
Just to hear his voice.
Yeah.
That was in the mid-60s before I met him.
Yeah.
And that was an exciting thing. Bill wanted to capture the essence of what those people were.
You know, if it were just the conversation alone, I mean, you talk about Mother Maybelle, and she asked about, and I want you to, she asked a question about how, you know, can she do this song a certain way?
Yeah, she said, well, I don't reckon she will do that, and I'd like to do Wildwood Flower on the auto harp, but that would be an F natural. And the other ones I'd do an F. Now, what she meant by that was, Maybelle Carter turned her guitar half flat, but she tuned the auto harp to regular pitch,
okay.
Half natural.
Okay.
So when she played a C chord on her guitar, it was actually a B.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. One of my favorite bits of the conversation, and I can't talk to John McEwen without talking about that Will the Circle, and I don't mean to do that all the time. One of my favorite bits of the conversation was Doc Watson met Merle Travis.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the intentions of Bill, and I found out early on that Doc wanted to meet Merle Travis, but Merle Travis wanted to meet Doc Watson, and that was something that they both looked forward to.
So
we knew that when we arranged to have Merle come to the studio while Doc was recording, I'll never forget when I walked in and they started talking. I had to stop them. My brother's in the control room, frantically pointing at the mic and getting a stick of vocal mics in front of Travis. You can hear me going, excuse me. Yeah, Merle, just move over here a little bit. So he wouldn't be off mic.
Well, and it's Doc is like I would be, you know. I mean, with here's Doc Watson talking to Merle, but I got an album that I kind of like want you to sign later, and he tells Merle that his son is named after him, and then Merle just talks about, you know, the great plane. But that moment to me is just something that the fact that you were able to capture it and be available for it because you knew they both had never met, and just the natural conversation that springs the admiration, and the both of them are kind of stunned that they have the opportunity to sit and talk to each other for the first time. It just, to me, that's just an amazing moment of that whole.
I love the part where Doc says, you know my favorite album? And he gets around to tell her, he goes, oh, that old thing, I put that old thing together in about a week. You know?
Oh, gosh.
Hearing him downplay his wonderful work.
They were all so humble. You had such a collection of the greats of the greats. And as everybody says, well, I remember when it came out, I believe even the label said, if you only buy one country, they called it country then, if you only buy one country album, you have to buy this one. And that's kind of what everybody did, and they're still doing it.
That's fine with me.
Yeah, I know. That's why I don't mind talking about it. But to me, that's just a magic. That whole set, and then it kind of changed. I think things changed. Maybe some music changed after that. Maybe there were more opportunities for what might be called today Americana or Roots or something. Maybe that... The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, what they were doing up to that point, and even including that and beyond, kind of opened a lot of doors, I think. Don't you think? I mean, it kind of changed.
I've been told that the band was very likely the first group that could actually be classed as Americana.
Yeah.
And that would be because of instrumentation, song choice, people that we've recorded with. You know, we were playing songs that were written by contemporaries or Hank Williams. Or something from the 30s.
Yeah.
And sometimes recording with somebody from Leon Russell to Doc Watson to Linda Ronstadt, you know, and bringing this breeding, crossbreeding of the genres together on some songs.
Well, and don't you think it was so much easier then because there weren't so many spelled out, specified genres? I mean, you guys were playing music. I don't think, were you thinking we're going to mix these things up? Maybe you were, but in reality, back in those days, we didn't have so many well-defined placards. If you could find a music store, you know, this is that and that and that and that, you just kind of had music.
We were very fortunate to be able to have the times in the studio that not everybody would have. A lot of people were trying to get a record deal or trying to get something made or out there. And as much as some people make disparaging comments about the record labels, they often did give you the platform to work from. And although it didn't always seem like the best, the suits at the label say this. Well, I think that the thing that should be recognized is that it was easier then to get a record out in Tacoma, Tampa, and Tuscaloosa on the same week when you had a company that was dedicated to that.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
I do. I understand
what you're saying. That would help create some commercial success, or at least give it a chance. And if it was successful, it would allow other things to happen. I swear that some Bojangles and Shelter Blues and that Uncle Charlie album wouldn't have been successful, and the Circle album wouldn't have been able to happen.
You're right. You're right.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. And there's so many combinations of things that click. And then, of course, you see things happen where it seems like everything's perfect, but nobody heard it. You know,
yeah.
Emmylou Harris and some people made an album in the late 70s about Jesse James. She haven't thought about that in years, but it's absolutely wonderful. And nobody heard it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's been a lot of records that just didn't click. The Dirt Band has put out many. And, you
oh,
know,
yes.
We 30-plus albums over the years. Recorded 350 songs, and let's just say half of them, okay, maybe half of them sucked and they wouldn't have a life anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But that still leaves about 150.
Yeah, you're right.
Out of those, only maybe 25 would be recognizable. Yeah. And then only the certain groups.
Right, that's right. That's right.
I mean, we have had in the country charts, I think, 18 top 10 records. On the pop charts, 3. And then some eclectic FM type of cuts. We made an album after the Circle album called Stars and Stripes Forever that made it to the top 20 on the pop charts without a radio song. And it was basically Cajun rock and a live album. The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band didn't have its first number one song until 1981, I think it was, a song called Long Hard Road on the country charts.
Okay.
But see, even that had to have certain things happen that would allow it to go to number one. You want an inside record business explanation of that comment?
Absolutely. The floor is yours.
Well, I was told by the manager of the group at the time, Chuck Morris, he says, I got a call today from Warner Brothers, and they said that they had to pick which song was going to be allowed to go forward. Because it worked on a point basis. You had to have airplay, request, sales, and one other thing that attributed to. One of the songs was number 5, and one of their artists was number 6. No, we were number 6, and the other guy had one at number 5.
Okay.
And Warner Brothers was told by Billboard, we're going to move one of the songs up, but one of them has to go. They both have the same number of points. You pick. So instead of T.G. Shepherd getting another number one song, they said, move the Dirt Band up.
Really?
T.G. Shepherd's record went from 5 to 12. Ours went from 6 to 5, or 4. And then it went on to number one. And then there's things about the number of stations playing it contributing to those points. And it wasn't getting played on 5 essential country stations. Crack in Sacramento, the one in Phoenix that was owned by Buck Owen, run by Buck Owen's son, and 3 others that I can't remember. So I called those stations myself, and I said, I understand you're not playing Long Hard Road. Why is that? And the comment was, it's too country. And I say, well, excuse me, aren't you a country station? Well, yeah. And we love your stuff. I said, well, look, do this for me. Play Long Hard Road, and if it doesn't work, I'll never bother you again. Just give it a shot. See, it may be too country for what you're hearing, but maybe your audience will like it. The lyric is so perfect. Rodney Crowell wrote Long Hard Road.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, they played it, and they got requests, and they kept it on. And because of those 5 stations and what happened with the T.G. Shepherd record, he found out about that later and left the label. But T.G. Shepherd had like 30 number one songs by then, and
right.
They figured, well, let's get the new group in there.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of parameters that happen, all kinds of conditions.
Are those conditions or those options even available to an artist today? Like you, can you even find out which stations are playing?
Yeah. Some of the things never change, and some of them are added to or change. I mean, now you have to have, if you want to try and get a record deal, don't just go to Nashville with a song. Go there with 3 songs, 2 music videos, a manager, an agent, a press kit, a YouTube channel, and a website that excites people, and a Facebook page that shows that you have 20,000 people that will buy your record. But go back to, you remember the show Laugh-In?
Sure.
Well, Dan Rowan, I asked him, I says, what do you attribute the major success to Laugh-In, because you came into a market. We were working with Rowan and Martin for a month.
Oh, yeah.
He says, well, when Dan Rowan and Martin.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we worked every toilet around the country, everywhere, every comedy club, any place that would have us for 10 years. I kept an index file on everybody. I took names and phone numbers and addresses from the audience. This is what he was doing in the 60s.
Wow.
He had a file that had 2,500 names in it. He said, when we did our show, we sent out letters to every one of them. He said, catch our new show. Write them a letter. NBC got more letters than they'd ever had for a pilot show.
Huh.
And that's what kept their show working. So it was old school. But that type of thing, now it's, you got to have a lot of YouTube hits or Facebook.
Videos. You were right when you said videos. You got to have the snazzy videos anymore.
Well, you got to have a music video that kind of shows that you have an attitude or a point of view,
right,
or something going on that might be interesting. And then if you have that video, you can get it on YouTube. And mm-hmm. then it's best to have original music because nobody wants to hear the next greatest version of Yesterday or Rocky Top either, you know. So it's original music.
I
spent the last few weeks of December in Europe, and one of the most intriguing parts about the trip was the days I spent in Salzburg. I picked up a book about Mozart's life, and in that book, he talks about, long story short, Mozart needed money. He never had enough. I wrote a concerto, but the king hasn't paid me yet, and it looks like I'm going to get an opera. I'm going to do it in Italian, but I got to convince them that Italians, I want to do it in German. They want Italian. And I think a German opera, I'm going to call it Figaro, but nobody wants to do Figaro. But I'm telling them it's a comedy. It's not a political, you know. And along with that, I got to raise some money, and I'm working on the poster for the concert. He booked the concert hall, hire the musicians, make the tickets, and go out and promote it to play his own music in the concert hall to make money.
So that was the first Kickstarter program.
then he said, he was writing a letter to his dad, and one letter was talking about, I'm short on money. I need to raise 100 florins, so I'm going to do a concert in my house. He said a house concert.
Holy moly. Wow. We thought all that was new.
What's new here? If I hadn't said Mozart, I could have described that situation. You would have thought it was some guitar player in Tennessee trying to make money, you know?
So you just have to be, if you're an artist, you just have to be aware that those things have to be, you just got to keep following those channels which are productive. I guess you have to make choices as to how you're going to get those things fleshed out a little bit.
You have to do everything to try and make it work.
Yeah.
And even Picasso was a great marketer. Van Gogh wasn't. Picasso was.
Well, Picasso.
They both great artists.
Yeah. Picasso would
make money while they were alive.
Yeah, Picasso would just walk around and put his signature on anything that was in front of him after a while.
Yeah, and he'd talk about how great his artwork was.
That's right.
And believe in it, and get other people to talk about it. Whatever.
Well, talking about great artwork, John McEwen is a great artist. You have a website now because you don't have any videos that I know. New videos that I know of.
I have plenty of videos on the website and my YouTube channel.
Yeah.
You can find on YouTube.
Okay.
I'm easy to find if you just put John Nitty Gritty in Google. My website comes up to the top.
Okay. And I know when we were talking the other day, or at least texting the other day, that you're doing some shows in the, is it the Northwest or the West or somewhere out there?
Northeast. Well, Northeast. I've got shows, the first shows of the year I'll be playing in Shirley, Massachusetts on the 23rd.
Okay.
Shirley, Mass at the Bull Run Restaurant, which when I got the contract, I had a Bull Run Restaurant. And I played a diner, and I looked into it, and this place opened in 1740. It's been a gathering place in that part of Massachusetts for years. And then the next night I'm in Old Saybrook, which is at the Katharine Hepburn Cultural Performing Arts Center. Mm-hmm. And at the Cape, they call it the Cape. That's findable by thecape.org. I'll be using their big screen to show early footage of the Dirt Band and the photos of the Circle album cut together in a way that is incorporated to the music live on stage.
Oh, that would be nice.
It's really fun.
I've been doing
a lot of video shows lately.
Yeah.
Multimedia.
That would be nice.
And it's coming right along.
Then
after that, I'm doing 3 dates in Colorado. February 6, 7, and 8, I'll be in Colorado. Steamboat Rifle and Evergreen. And that's on my website. All these are on the website.
Sure.
And then in the middle of February, I'm doing two shows up in Canada around Edmonton with John Carter Cash. And I put together a show with John Carter. He's the son of John and June Cash. And four other players. It is a video excursion into the Circle album and the Carter family.
Oh, that's nice. That'd be nice.
With the music live on stage. And stories about what's going on screen. Backed up by the music.
That's great. That's great. And, John, when you're out traveling, I mean, do you have a band? Do you travel? How many instruments do you take? Your banjo? What else do you take? Guitar? Whatever else you take with you?
Well, for the dates in Massachusetts and Colorado, Matt Cartsonis will be going with me.
Okay.
And he's findable on the internet, Cartsonis, okay. MattCartsonis.com. He spent the last 6 years of Warren Zevon's life backing him up and has been in a lot of groups. Matt's a guy I've played with for 30 years.
Okay.
He's kind of my non-dirt band musician buddy,
okay.
You know. And we usually have more fun than anything we do when we play together. He's a great guy, and he's a wonderful singer. Has that high, lonesome sound, and plays mandola and guitar.
Mm.
And then for the John Carter shows, it's Les Thompson, one of the original Dirt Band members. He was on the Circle album. He's playing bass, and Matt, and then two other players from Nashville. And then sometimes it's just me. In March, I have two dates in Oregon that will be solo dates, in Ashland and I can't remember the other town right now. It's up by Portland.
Well, John, you obviously still enjoy getting out and performing live. I mean, I think that's, as much as we talked about the recording industry, I think that from what I know about you and from what I see you doing, you're still going out performing live. There must be some really extra kind of award, I mean, just monetarily, from performing live in front of audiences, as you've done it so long.
Well, it's not easy. Sometimes you travel to get to work is 15 hours, and you get there late at night, and then your show's not till the next day, and, you know, you do all this time of your life to go do an hour and a half, 2 hours. But, yeah, it's what I do. It's what I wanted to do for years. Years ago, as a teenager, I thought, how fun that could be. I like seeing the world and the country, and I have people ask me that question.
Okay, I thought I was the first one.
Pardon?
I thought I was the first one. No?
Yeah, maybe you're the first one. It's like, what's not to like? I just feel privileged that I have places I can go, that I can walk on stage, and there'll be people there. And I do try to make more people show up every time, and usually when I go back somewhere, there's more people because it worked good the last time.
Mm.
And I guess you could say I'm still trying to make it, because what I do individually, solo, is no... the Dirt Band can sell out a 1,500-seat hall. I can do 300 or 400 people. But I think I could, if that hall was fulfilled for me, it would be every bit as good.
Yeah.
It would be, oh my gosh, would that be fun?
You need to.
I'd have fun with a 300 or 400 or the 200 or whatever it is.
You know, you're going east coast, up northeast, and then out west, and you're avoiding the Midwest, which is where I am geographically. You need to find some place to hone back in the Midwest area.
Well, I'm not avoiding it as much as it hasn't come up yet.
Okay.
I do play the Midwest, but yeah, I will look forward to that.
Yeah, we'll find something.
And it does happen.
We'll find something. Well, I'll scout around. We'll find something, and I'd love to have you be local, and then I could talk to you and run right up and see you. That'd be great.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. John, listen, man, I appreciate you remembering to get a hold of me. That was very nice of you. The holidays kind of got busy, and I was thrilled that you said, hey, I'm sorry I missed you. What can we do? Which is exactly how it happened. And I thought, no, this is nice. So I appreciate you being available. And all the music that you've done and you're still doing and everything is still fresh to you. It's just amazing. And when that book is
I came up with a kind of analogy.
Okay.
I was doing an interview earlier today, and the guy was asking about, you're still doing this. What makes it, is it challenging? I said, well, you know, Steve, this is like, it's like playing chess. If you love to play chess, you'll play chess with anyone. You know, at least I do. And when you're playing chess, there's somebody across the table that you're trying to maneuver, influence, whatever. Well, going on stage to me is like playing chess with one person, only it's the audience. An audience is a singular noun.
Oh, I like that. I like that.
And so I go out there and I feel like I'm talking to one person, trying to beat them. And by beating them, it means you're getting into them, doing something they like.
I think as long as you keep thinking that way, you're going to be in good shape, John.
I got a few matches coming up that I'm looking forward to.
You got a few what?
Matches.
Oh.
Chess matches.
Chess matches.
Audience.
Yeah. So you, sometimes you walk in and it's Bobby Fischer sitting there looking at you.
Oh, no.
Oh, man. I don't know. I don't know, John. Gosh, I love everything you've done. I love the fact that you've taken the banjo and something that's near and dear to me and made it, you know, so accessible for so many people. And we could name all the names that you were influenced by and the people that you've influenced. But everybody knows that John McEwen is, you are the string wizard and the banjo player. I mean, that's just the way it is. You get to live with it, pal. It's reality.
I have to live up to my own
height. All right, John. Listen, thanks so much, John McEwen. And you have the doors always open, wherever you're flying.
Okay.
If you want to text me and say, I want to be on, you can be on whenever you want to, John.
Well, let people know I'm up there in Massachusetts because it's not my strongest market.
Okay.
Looking forward to getting there.
All right, we'll do that. All right, John McEwen, thanks, man.
Like I said to my mom, thanks for having me.
I'll talk to you later again. All right, see you. Bye.
Okay.
There's John McEwen. Boy, there's a lot going on, a lot of music history there with John, and it's just all good. It's all good.